Okay, let's dive in. So imagine there's this whole other layer to the financial world, one that operates almost completely hidden, known apparently to maybe only one person in like 10,000.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. The sources you share describe this world where money isn't just traded like on the stock market, but it's supposedly created through trading very specific bank debt instruments, all privately.
Exactly. And that's what we're unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into what the sources call private placement programs, or sometimes just trades.
Right.
Our goal here is really to take these documents you've shared and just pull them apart, you know, look at the history they describe, figure out the mechanics, how they supposedly work, and touch on the kind of impact they're said to have.
And the material, it traces this whole thing back decades, connected to some pretty big moments in global history, and lays out this really intricate process involving major banks and a unique type of transaction.
So get ready, because we're exploring a corner of finance that these sources claim is known to just a tiny, tiny fraction of people. It's supposedly built on private deals, leverage, and a type of trading that sounds, frankly, completely different from what you see on the news.
You really guess.
So first things first, what are these private placement programs, these PPPs or trades? What do the sources actually define them as?
Well, based on the material, they're described as private deals, transactions involving trading specific bank-issued debt instruments that are bought at a discount.
Okay, debt instruments.
Yeah, the core idea presented is that money is created by creating debt.
Yeah.
So these programs, they trade instruments that are basically IOUs from major banks. Yeah. Deferred payment obligations.
IOUs from banks, like what kind specifically? Do the sources give examples?
They do. They mention things like medium-term notes, MTNs. Think of them as a kind of bank promissory note.
Yeah.
Then there are bank guarantees, BGs, where a bank promises to pay if its client defaults. And also standby letters of credit, SBLCs, which are pretty similar, guaranteeing payment. The sources claim these are issued, like, daily. Billions of dollars worth, usually at a discount.
Okay, so banks are issuing these debts and they're being traded. But the name private placement really emphasizes the private part. Why is that so crucial, according to these documents?
That's really the key difference. The sources are very clear. This specific type of trading, it can apparently only happen privately.
Why, though?
The reason given is to get around all the legal hurdles and regulations you find in the normal open market trading that everyone knows about. It's designed to operate outside that public system.
Huh. Fascinating. So private trading of bank debt to bypass public rules. But where did this whole kind of niche world even come from? The sources trace it back quite a way.
They do, yeah. The material says the history goes back to the 1930s, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Developed apparently right after the global depression by the U.S. and Switzerland.
Wow, the 30s. Interesting timing, right after that huge crash. What was the inspiration for it back then?
It was supposedly based on a unique money lending and money creation system that was operating back then in Siam.
Siam, you mean modern day Thailand?
That's the one. That's what the source claims.
That's unexpected. And the source says this wasn't just some dusty idea from the 30s. It got a major boost, updated significantly, in 1944. Why then?
Well, 1944, you know, the world was just shattered by World War II. You had economic ruin everywhere, immense human suffering. The global economy desperately needed something new, something radical to rebuild.
Which leads us to that famous meeting at Bretton Woods, right?
Exactly. July 1944, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. You had about 130 of the top economic, social, political minds gathered there. Sure. And the key figure, according to these sources, was John Maynard Keynes.
The famous economist. Father of macroeconomics.
That's him. British economist, Nobel Peace Prize nominee 3 times. And the sources claim he presented a pretty radical plan there, supposedly drawing on that earlier Siam experience.
And the goal was?
To rebuild the world economy and maybe even help stop future wars like the one they just lived through.
And his ideas, the documents say, were key in setting up some big institutions we still know today.
Yes, they're reportedly linked straight to founding the IMF International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS.
Wow.
And the sources describe these institutions as now managing and operating a financing structure that evolved from those ideas. Its first big test, apparently, was the plan that financed rebuilding Europe and Asia after both world wars. So the roots of this, or the concepts behind it, are described as being really deeply embedded in that post-war financial setup.
Okay, so if the open market is public auctions, needing cash up front, how does this closed private market actually function, especially the part that sounds so odd that traders supposedly don't need the client's money in hand.
Right. That's where it really veers off from standard trading. Normal trading, open market, spot market, auction bids you buy low, hope to sell high later. And yeah, you need the money to buy first.
You got to own it to sell it.
Exactly. But this private market, as described, is super exclusive. It's made up of a small number of players called master commitment holders. Think trusts, foundations, huge pools of money.
Okay, and what do these master commitment holders do?
They make deals, contracts, with major banks to buy a certain amount of these fresh cut instruments, like the MTNs, at a specific price, over a specific time. But here's the thing, they don't actually hold them.
They don't, so they contract to buy. Who do they sell to immediately?
They already have contracts lined up with sub-commitment holders to sell the instruments to them.
Another layer.
Yep. And those sub-commitment holders, in turn, have pre-arranged contracts to sell them again, this time to the exit buyers.
And who are the exit buyers? The end of the chain.
Usually, yeah. They're described as big financial players, large institutions, pension funds, insurance companies, maybe even incredibly wealthy individuals. They're the final buyers in this preset chain.
So it's not like buying something and then looking for someone to sell it to. It's buying because the next buyer and the one after that are already locked in by contract.
Precisely. The source calls this whole pre-planned, contracted buy-sell dance with all the prices agreed in advance arbitrage. That's apparently the engine of how trading works in this private market.
And this is how the source explains that really counterintuitive part. That the traders supposedly never need to control the client's money to do the arbitrage. How does that work then? What are the banks and the client's funds actually doing?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it leads right into the bank's role and how client money makes it all possible without actually being spent on the trades themselves.
Okay, let's get into the bank's role. The source says they don't actually do the trading. So how do they make money from this, according to the material?
Indirectly.
Mm.
Mainly by providing leverage. So based on the client's funds being held securely, the bank gives the trader a line of credit, leverage money. The bank charges interest on that line of credit. That's one way they profit.
Ah, okay. Interest on the loan.
Right. And they also apparently get commissions on each transaction when it settles.
So the bank provides the credit line, the fuel for the trade, using the client's parked funds as the basis. And the source mentions this is often off balance sheet. What does that mean here?
It basically means these activities don't initially show up on the bank's main financial statements like regular deposits do. They're more like memo items until cash actually flows. And a key point the source makes is that the bank apparently doesn't face the same tough capital reserve rules for these activities because there isn't a direct deposit liability for the bank during the trade itself. It's more of a temporary contingent thing.
Interesting. And none of this can even start without the client's money involved somewhere.
Correct. The source is clear. A program can't kick off unless there's enough backing for each potential transaction down the line. The client's funds provide that essential backing.
But wait, you said the trader doesn't spend the client's money. If it's not being used for the arbitrage buy-sell, what is it doing, just sitting there?
Pretty much, but it has a crucial role. According to the source, the client's principal isn't spent. It serves as what's called a compensating balance.
Compensating balance.
Yeah, think of it like collateral. It's mirrored or reserved by the bank. It's the guarantee against that line of credit they give the trader. And the key thing is, the funds have to be unencumbered or blocked, basically locked down so they can't be touched or used for anything else while the trading's happening.
I see. So the client's cash sits safe, acting as the security blanket that lets the bank lend the trader, say, 10 times that amount. The source mentioned a 10.1 leverage ratio.
Exactly. The host trading bank extends that credit line to the trader, loaning against the client's blocked deposit. The source says typically 10.1, yeah, sometimes even 10 to 20 times the principal.
Mm.
And that credit line is what backs the arbitrage deals, even though the actual credit line money isn't necessarily spent like you'd buy a stock. It's more about having the backing in place.
And the client's original money, is it actually safe during all this maneuvering?
The source emphasizes safety. It states the client's funds typically stay secure, often in an escrow account. It even mentions some special trade setups where the client's funds are reportedly returned 100%, say within 60 banking days, no matter how the trades using the leverage actually performed.
This whole thing, it sounds so incredibly different from normal banking and trading.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally see why the source says most bankers and finance pros are just baffled or skeptical.
You nailed it. That's a huge point the source makes. Because this private market is so separate from their day-to-day world, it's invitation only, completely closed off from the public markets. They know most financial folks find it really hard to even believe it exists, let alone works this way.
Right.
The source says it operates at a level within a network that most mainstream players just aren't part of. It's supposedly known to like 1/100th of 1% of people. That's it.
So is it safe then? I mean, with these kinds of claims, this level of secrecy, what do the sources say about the actual safety mechanisms?
Well, the source argues that the safety is built into the arbitrage process itself. Because you're buying and immediately reselling instruments at prices that are already agreed upon, backed by contracts.
Ah, so the security isn't market speculation, it's the contracts being solid.
That's the argument. The source stresses these programs reportedly don't even begin unless all the players in that arbitrage chain, the buyer, the seller, the intermediaries, are already locked in by contract. Everyone knows their role, their price, their profit, the whole flow, the contracts, the bank leverage against collateral, the quick settlement. It supposedly follows very strict, established, rapid procedures.
And the skepticism comes from people trying to apply regular market logic to it.
That seems to be the source's explanation. You know, the usual thinking is you have to spend money to make money, like buying low and then hoping to sell high later, finding a buyer after you own it.
Right.
The source keeps saying arbitrage here is different because the buyers are already lined up contractually before anything starts. You aren't looking for a buyer. They're already committed.
Still, even if it's different, there's always risk in finance, right? Stocks, bonds, real estate. Nothing's guaranteed. Does the source acknowledge that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The source is clear that just like any potential investment, you should be skeptical, understand there are risks, and definitely do your homework. Due diligence is crucial. And it really emphasizes the need to work only with ethical, reputable organizations with a proven track record in this very specific space.
Okay. We've gone through the history, the weird mechanics. What about the impact? What are these programs supposedly used for? Broadly, and for the people involved.
On the big picture level, the source cites analyses from the World Bank and IMF. Apparently, they've concluded that the money created through these PPPs gets absorbed by the labor and materials for the projects they fund. And these institutions reportedly don't worry about it causing inflation.
Interesting. And for specific uses, major projects.
Yeah, the sources say these programs have been used to generate funds for really big projects, especially in the developing world, sometimes talking funds in the tens of billions.
And the source we looked at specifically mentions an organization, Platform Funding Group. How do they fit in? What do they supposedly help clients do with this structure?
Right. Platform Funding Group is presented as one example of a group that helps clients access these kinds of programs. According to the material, they claim to help clients reach some pretty significant financial goals, often within specific time frames.
But what kind of goals?
Well, the source lists a few things. Helping clients build multi-generational wealth, often mentioning a 12 to 36 month time frame.
Okay.
For developers, it says they provide 100% funding for real estate projects without the client having to give up equity or get stuck with high interest debt for years. Same idea for entrepreneurs funding businesses or franchises funding without that lifelong debt burden.
Wow. Avoiding equity loss and long-term debt, that would be huge for developers and businesses. What about charities or just regular individuals?
For charities, Platform Funding Group apparently helps them set up sustainable funding, so they're not always chasing donations, allows them to focus on their actual work. And for individuals, maybe people feeling behind on retirement savings, the source suggests these programs can help them catch up significantly, again in that 12 to 36 month window, aiming for, you know, being debt-free and less stressed financially.
The source also gives some background on Platform Funding Group, its founder, Dr. Gregory Spencer, and mentions some recognitions.
It does, yeah. It points to acknowledgments for Dr. Spencer or the firm from places like the White House, the UN, the World Bank, World Economic Forum. Also mentions the firm has been around since 2001. The implication seems to be these recognitions add credibility in this very specialized field.
And how does his team supposedly work with clients in this very private world?
According to the source, Dr. Spencer's team works directly with, quote, successful trade desk teams to help clients navigate this. They seem to cater to a wide range of individuals, families, businesses, developers, nonprofits, corporations.
Now, the source mentioned that historically, maybe pre-2008 crash, you needed huge amounts, like $100 million, to get into these things, shutting out smaller players. Does Platform Funding Group still operate at that level?
That historical context is definitely mentioned. But then the source states that PFG's network can apparently work with client funds starting at $100,000. The idea is they use that $100 to leverage $1 million for the actual arbitrage transactions. So it suggests a way in for smaller amounts compared to that old standard.
Interesting. And if someone listening is intrigued or maybe still skeptical, the source says PFG welcomes direct contact.
It does. The material explicitly says they're open to direct conversations for any questions or concerns. And importantly, it stresses there are absolutely no upfront fees and that doing mutual due diligence is part of their process.
Wow. Okay. This has been quite the journey into a part of finance that feels, I don't know, almost like science fiction compared to the everyday stock market.
It's definitely different. We've touched on the surprising history, supposedly going back to Siam and Bretton Woods, unpacked the really complex private mechanics, the arbitrage, the leverage, using client funds as collateral, not capital to be spent.
Right. And we looked at the kind of impact these programs are described as having both globally and for participants, using Platform Funding Group as one example detailed in the sources for wealth building and project funding.
I think the biggest takeaway from all this material is the description of this parallel financial universe operating totally separate from the public markets, based on these private contracts and leveraging capital in ways that supposedly allow for wealth creation and funding at a speed and scale that's just hard to grasp through a traditional lens.
Which really leaves us, and you listening, with a pretty big thought to chew on. If this world described in the sources actually exists, this realm of significant money creation and funding known only to a tiny fraction, hidden even from most bankers, what does that really mean about how our financial systems truly work? And maybe more importantly, who actually gets access to these kinds of opportunities?
Yeah, definitely something to think about long after this deep dive is over.